That strange song called Legend of a Mind by the Moody Blues. It's about Timothy Leary. And we're going to talk more about Timothy Leary's Dead with Paul Davids in a moment. And then we'll get into his other film in Roswell, the UFO cover-up. It's a great story, too. And then we'll take your calls later on tonight on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Paul Davids. And Paul, let's get back to the Timothy Leary's Dead film. How do people watch it?
Well, they're going to have to look for the DVD online. And, you know, buy a used one if you can't find one that's new. The DVD not only has the 80-minute movie, it has a couple of hours of interview footage additional of Timothy and Baba Ramdas, Ralph Metzner, who also worked with them at Millbrook. So, but as far as seeing that ending scene, that scene with the head, you have a link to it now.
Yes.
Coast to Coast. You have a little article about it. It's connected with my bio. It says, click here for more information. And use the password Leary in all caps. And you can see that last 5 minutes. We made it look incredibly realistic.
For the faint at heart, should they still watch it?
Faint of heart? Well, knowing that we used a false head and what you're seeing isn't real. And I want to get into the why behind that. You see, because about 2 weeks before he died, Timothy changed his mind about this plan. He'd been planning for 10 years.
So he wanted his head frozen, didn't he?
Oh, he did. He absolutely did. But for some reason, he changed his mind. Look, he said, I don't want in 100 years them to wake me up and there's my head and my brain being experimented on by a bunch of guys in white coats. And then he also said, jokingly, and God forbid, what if they should wake me up during a Republican administration? But he did opt for cremation, and he was entirely cremated. And they scratched the plan for the preservation of the head and his DNA. They were also supposed to save vials of his blood for the DNA, and they didn't do any of it in the end. And here I had my movie filled with Timothy telling his plan. I had the head so I could film the final scene. And so here's the question. Why did I proceed with that, and why did I leave it ambiguous? Because I never admitted to anyone, really publicly, I think until tonight, that...
It was a spoof.
Yeah. Now, I want to say that this movie, Timothy Leary's Dead, it's a 1996 film. It's the year he died. And it had reviews everywhere. And I'm talking about the New York Times, the L.A. Times, Variety, the Village Voice, Playboy. Every major publication in the United States reviewed it. And I'd say 90% of the reviewers thought that the head scene at the end was real.
Yes.
Some of them attacked me for it being in absolutely terrible taste. I think there was a reviewer in San Francisco actually said on the radio that there were 16 seconds of the severed head in the movie, and I should be sent to jail 1 year for each one of those seconds.
Oh,
16 years in jail for Paul Davids for that scene. I mean, it aroused the hatred of a lot of people that I went ahead and did that, including a lot of people that were close to Tim resented that I showed that in the movie, because their attitude was, look, Tim changed his mind. Why didn't you just respect the fact that he changed his mind and just tell everybody that it didn't happen? Now, I felt that here was the value in having the ambiguity about it. As long as Timothy Leary's head really was preserved, there was the possibility that he could be brought back.
That's right.
He was considered the most dangerous man alive. The establishment hated him. And what better than to have the establishment off guard, not knowing whether when he was cremated, the head was cremated along with him. And maybe the head did still exist. Maybe Alcor had it. Or maybe it wasn't Alcor. Maybe it was another company. But somebody would be wanting to find the head and pull the plug, you see? And I wanted that mystery out there. I wanted that aggravation to the establishment as an homage to Tim and what he really wanted. He can't come back now. We can value him through his incredible array of writings. Read his book, Flashbacks. It's one of the most wonderful books I've ever read. It only takes his story up through the time when he really got out of jail. But I will say that there were a couple of reviewers that caught on and that said, you know, that that Timothy, here's Daily Variety. I just want to read that they said that the sequence looks real enough, but the documentary makes a convincing case that it would take a force far more powerful than death to keep Timothy Leary from staging a farewell practical joke. Okay? Huh. And a reviewer in Toronto said, somewhere over the rainbow, Timothy Leary is laughing his head off, if, in fact, he still has a head. So
beautiful.
This controversy that was created, look, it gave me...
He would have liked that ending.
Yes.
He would have.
Of course he would have. And Ralph Metzner, his close associate, who worked with him and co-wrote the Psychedelic Experience book with him, wanted to slug me. You might have been there, George. It was at one of the... I think it was one of the Open Minds UFO conferences, and I won a bunch of EBE awards there, and Ralph Metzner happened to be there, and someone told him that not only had he made the Sci-Fi Boys that won these awards, but that I had made Timothy Leary's Dead. And he approached me, and he was so angry, and he said, you know, you demean Tim with that ending. Why would you do that? And he almost slugged me. I mean, they had to restrain him.
Well, yeah, he was the guy shouting at you.
Yes, yes, exactly. And this was somebody I respected. He's in the movie. He contributed a great deal to the movie. And you see, it's a misunderstanding. They didn't understand the great value in demonstrating, showing what Tim wanted to do. And although I didn't admit that it was false, I did, in the ending, spend the whole end credits showing us plastering Timothy Leary's head and making a mold of his head.
Well, I didn't realize that it was false until I started doing the research for the show.
Sure.
I saw the trailer in the movie first, and I went, my God, that's authentic.
Listen.
His eyes were closed and everything else.
Yeah. Listen to what Janet Maslin said. She's a reviewer for the New York Times, one of the greats. And she said that the film's biggest accomplishment is to make that final image of Timothy Leary's head seem like a logical extension of Leary's escapades and create one last trippy frisson. He's not gone. He's waiting. And that's my point. Waiting for marijuana to be legalized.
Yeah.
25 years later, look at our society today. There's still half the country where you could probably be arrested for possession. But there's half the country where you can't be. That's some progress. You know, and It was Timothy that fought this battle, that these drugs that affect our neurology, that have an impact on our brain, can open the brain to new possibilities, new creativity. They're valuable. They need to be studied. The evidence now is that psilocybin, the magic mushrooms, may be an extremely valuable drug for dealing with depression. LSD has always had therapeutic possibilities. In fact, Cary Grant, way before LSD was illegal, was treated with LSD in his psychotherapy. But the craziness of the Nixon administration, the war on drugs, Nancy Reagan and Just Say No, and all of that, the incarceration of people that promoted these ideas, persecuted for their ideas, and penalized for simply possessing these things. This is what we had to live through. And by doing this head scene, now, 25 years later, I can show you the scene, show you what Timothy wanted to do. He did believe cryogenics was possible. And we can look back at his legacy.
Well, the two surgeons, that's what got me.
The surgeons, yes. Yes. Right. They wore surgical get-ups, and we made it look incredibly realistic. In fact, the head was created. I know you want to talk about Roswell. Well, Steve Johnson owned a special effects company called XFX, and he created the aliens that we used in the Showtime movie Roswell, including the living one, which is now in my office.
Aha, okay.
In Sedona. And I asked, I commissioned... Steve and his team to create the Timothy Leary head. They did such an incredible job. I want to say that every beard stubble hair is there. You can go to the website of Heritage Auctions, where they have a couple of pictures of it in great detail. and you see, you know, every freckle, every...
Oh, it looks real.
Yeah.
It looks, it truly does look real.
Yeah, and I'm ready to part with it. We're also parting with the white suit that Timothy had in the movie with the auction. And one other thing, from his ranch that he lived in was recovered the LSD blotter greeting cards that were printed, that were only used among the psychedelic in-crowd at that time. And these were had colorful greeting cards that had colorful psychedelic patterns and a little round circle in the middle where they would put a 300 microgram pill of LSD. Well, these cards that I have that came from Leary's ranch, they don't have any LSD pill on them, but these are the cards that were used at that time. They're historic, you know, from the 1960s.
Are you going to put a minimum bid on the head?
Yeah, there's a minimum bid, and, you know, we think it, you know, we thought, let's put a low minimum bid on it so that
what is it?
A lot of
can
people
I ask?
Can get involved, you know, and then it can be exciting if there's people that want to.
What's the minimum? Do you know?
I think it's a couple thousand dollars, somewhere around there.
It'll probably go for at least that.
Yeah. I think so. I think so.
Especially after this
show. You never can tell. You know, my fantasy is that one of the guys in Silicon Valley, you know, will fight it out with another heavyweight. Yeah. But
you need Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk to battle it out.
Well, it's a shame Steve Jobs isn't here because Steve Jobs took LSD.
$1 million for Timothy Leary's head.
Yeah. Steve Jobs said that the LSD massively opened up doors in his mind that influenced his creativity for the rest of his life.
Probably did.
Yeah.
Probably did.
Yeah, yeah. Now, it doesn't do that for everyone. Let's be clear here.
Well, wasn't there a CIA guy who tried it and jumped out of a building or something?
Well, we don't know whether he jumped or he was pushed. You're talking
about
Frank
Olson. No, we don't. That's true.
Frank Olson. This was during the MK Ultra days when the CIA was using this as a truth drug experimentation. And we think that Frank Olson was a troublemaker, and we don't know that that's really what happened. He could have been killed. We don't know. But, you know, I just want to say, not everybody has a good experience from this. We know this. What Timothy felt in contradicting the advice of Aldous Huxley and going out to the world and saying, here's his phrase, turn on, tune in, drop out. He wanted to turn on the world, and he knew that there would be collateral damage, what they call collateral damage. You know, some people might have a very bad result from it.
Sure.
Art Linkletter's daughter did, and he hated Timothy Leary, and he blamed Leary for his daughter's death. So, yes, some bad results, but Leary felt that in the overall, that this was something that could change the world, you know, for the better.
And he wanted it controlled, didn't he?
Listen, he wanted it controlled at a certain point in time. When he was called before a Senate committee and he had to testify to Senator Edward Kennedy, was cross-examining him and really cornered him. And Leary said, look, we think that these should be licensed to be able to be used by responsible adults for psychotherapeutic reasons and research. At that point, he said, license it. But where he evolved to after that was... No, everyone should have access to it. And then you saw what happened with Ken Kesey and the electric Kool-Aid acid test and Owsley manufacturing, you know, a million doses and giving it everywhere. And then you had the 1960s. You had Haight-Ashbury, which all ended with Charles Manson.
Absolutely. Well, I want to talk about
all history.
Let's talk about Roswell, and then we'll take calls after the break. They're lining up here for you, Paul.
Oh, could I ask you?
Yeah.
Could I ask you, George? I'd like to take 2 minutes just to say what I've been doing in the last year and a half during the COVID years.
We'll do that right before the break.
Okay.
2 minutes you need. Okay, but Roswell, tell me about how you got involved in that.
Well, the Roswell movie. Okay, first, 1987, February 25th, my kids and I had a UFO sighting in broad daylight from our house. And this made an instant convert out of me that these things were real. And I wasn't a believer up to that point. I was kind of ignorant. I hadn't read the books. But after that, I poured into the research, and with some help from both Robert Wise, the director of The Day the Earth Stood Still, and Roy Thinnes, who was in the television
show
Invaders, I discovered about the Roswell case. I met Donald Schmidt. I met Kevin Randall. They were working on a book at that time.
Good
they
people.
Urged me to get involved in turning it into a film. I optioned their material. I fought for years to get it made. We had a couple of years of one rejection after another. It was a bitter experience. We were picked up at HBO. They developed it over a year and a half. They had Arthur Copet write the actual screenplay. They dragged it out a year and a half of writing, draft, seven drafts. And then they killed the project.
Oh,
and I was tearing my hair out.
They spent all that money and killed the project.
Yeah. But one of the producers involved, Eileen Konpower at HBO, she had strong contacts over at Showtime. She said, look, they're killing us here at HBO. Let me take it to Showtime. Maybe they'll buy HBO out. HBO would probably take 50 cents on the dollar for all the money that they spent, and maybe we get it made at Showtime. I was so skeptical and pessimistic at that time and bitter, I thought, this isn't going to happen. But over the next 6 weeks, it was read by all the important people at Showtime.
And they loved it.
She called me up. She said, we got to go. She said, not only are they going to do it, but they're going to give us a bigger budget than we would have had over at HBO, and they want to make it soon.
It was a great movie. Martin Sheen was fantastic.
He was. And so Kyle MacLachlan.
Oh, yeah.
Who played Jesse Marcel. And then you had Dwight Yoakam playing the rancher Mac Brazel. The movie became sort of a classic. And to see that movie, if you Google Roswell, the UFO cover-up movie, you'll find it online. I think the director has put it on Vimeo.
Yeah,
you'll find it. You'll be able to see.
Okay, now take your 2 minutes. Go ahead.
All right. You have grandchildren, right?
I have six grandchildren, two great-grandchildren.
Okay, we love our grandchildren. And I have a granddaughter just turned 8. And under her inspiration, I got involved in two wonderful projects for children that are both out there, and I want to tell everybody about it. One is called The Gimwits. You can find it, thegimwits.com is one of my websites given at Coast.
Gimwits.
And you can remember it from, you know, dimwit. Somebody's a dimwit. But this, The Gimwits, begins with a G and it has two M's and two T's. And these are fantasy characters that inhabit different worlds that are these delightful, wonderful characters who travel from world to world and have to combat the gimwits, the bad gimwits that are called the Waste Kings. Think Blue Meanies in Yellow Submarine. The Waste Kings want to spew garbage across the entire Gimwit universe. And so it has this ecological theme. So it's beautifully, beautifully illustrated by Melanie Joy Bacon. And we have four adventure books. So that's The Gimwits. Now, 1 minute on my other project for kids, which you can find at Amazon Prime. It's like a television series of 12 episodes called The Grand Kingdom of Cookie Land.
That's and yours?
That's mine, The Grand Kingdom of Cookie Land.
Oh, good for
and
you.
It has puppets interacting with kids, and the puppets of Cookie Land are very mischievous. They lie, and the main character, the little girl, has a science fiction lie detector, and she wires the puppets up to it to get to the truth. It's a wonderful, fun adventure, and it weaves in a lot of contemporary themes in it, like protests, like elections in the different episodes. But it's harmless fun, and with the puppets, you'll think of the Muppets, you'll think of Kukla Frananalli and all these other things that have been. I was inspired by the movie Lily with Leslie Caron, where she interacts with the puppets in the circus. So that's what I did, these 12 television episodes with helps from Ron James, who's instrumental on MUFON TV. And you can find them at Amazon Prime.
Yeah, Ron's a good guy, too. We're going to come back, Paul, and take promised phone calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM. And we'll be back in a moment with Paul Davids and take final phone calls here on Coast to Coast. Next hour, Elizabeth Joyce, the psychic, joins us. We'll talk about some of her past predictions. Some of them are uncanny. Her sports picks, not that good, but her other ones, she did a great job. And then later on, we'll take some calls with her on Coast to Coast. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie back with Paul Davids, author, filmmaker as well. And what favorite title do you prefer, Paul?
You mean of the different movies that I've made?
Of everything you've done. Do you like to be called the film producer, an author? What do you prefer?
Oh, well, most of my career has been as a film producer and director. I've made about 10 feature films.
That's a lot.
You know, before I was a producer, I was production coordinator at Marvel, like I told you, for the Transformers. And, you know, I've authored a lot of books. We talked about the Star Wars books. But, you know, mainly my profession, what's paid the bills, has been making these movies. They've been lower budget than most movies, you know, and most of them have been made independently, except for, like, the one for Showtime.
Mm-hmm.
But by keeping the budgets low, and by choosing really interesting topics that people wanted to know more about, most of them have been, you know, successful.
That's smart.
Jesus in India continues to be very popular. Marilyn Monroe Declassified. You and I have spent a show talking about that,
mm-hmm.
that one. And the Life After Death Project. I want to say some of my movies you can see easily at Amazon Prime, like The Sci-Fi Boys is there. That's Peter Jackson hosts the history of special effects in movies. Jesus in India is there. The Life After Death Project 1 and The Life After Death Project 2, Personal Encounters. I know you've written a book about the life after death mystery and issues, and I've made two films about it that, as you know, one of them heavily deals with the mystery that followed Forrest J. Ackerman's death that led to that seance in his house that you talked about early in the show.
That's classic.
So those, you know, the Roswell movie was an enormous success for Showtime. Timothy Leary's dead. You know, it played theatrically. It got tremendous publicity. A lot of people had trouble with that ending, but when it went to the Toronto Film Festival, I want to say that one of the screenings had 1,200 people waiting in line as if it was Star Wars.
I like the ending. I think it was appropriate.
Thank you.
It did. Let's take some calls for you. Nathan in Knoxville, Tennessee, welcome to the show. Hey, Nathan, go ahead.
George, it's always an honor and a pleasure to get to speak with you, but it's a special treat for me tonight to be able to speak Mr. Davids. I am a combat veteran. I was born October 7th, 1979, and so I just turned 42 yesterday. And in 1984, I was 5 years old, and my favorite shows were G.I. Joe and Transformers.
That's great.
And I want you to know that the work that was done in that project has stuck with me and had such a profound influence, you know, for many, many years. It's been such a great source of joy and love. Even to this day, I own every episode from the Generation One Transformers, and I've raised my children, you know, they're aware of all the movies and everything. I said, but this is the core. This is the true Transformers. This is the storyline that you have to watch, that you have to know. And even the episodes that you worked on directly with, like Cosmic Rust and Grimlock's New Brain, those are some of my favorite, absolute favorite episodes.
Thank you. And those are ones that I wrote the scripts for. For those, and I wrote A Thief in the Night and one called Chaos. But my main job there was production coordinator, which meant handling the flow of all these shows, because we were always in the middle of five shows at once. It was on every single day. And you'll see my name as production coordinator on 79 of those episodes. It was a great, great run. As I say, Stan Lee was there at Marvel then, got to know him a little bit, got to see him in his most discouraged hour when Spider-Man had been rejected as a feature for like the fifth time and he was giving up, you know. But it was such a pleasure to be there working on the Transformers at Marvel. And I thought that most of the scripts that were really good science fiction stories, we had great story editors. They really worked on those stories to make them memorable. And I'm glad it had such an effect on you.
Let's go back to Nathan. Nathan, did you have a question for Paul?
Well, you know, it's just such a special time for animation and for the storytelling, and I wanted to say thank you to him and to all of the crew and cast that worked on that. The question I would have is, did you happen to voice any of the characters during any of the episodes?
No, I didn't voice the characters, but I was there at almost every single voice session. You know, we had over 100 different actors doing the voices. A lot of them had many voices, many characters. And, of course, Frank Welker, who did Megatron, and Peter Cullen, who was Optimus Prime. They were the superstars. So you know, it was a pleasure to be there in those sessions, but I was not a voice guy.
That's amazing. Truly is. Next up, let's go to Barry, Rock Hill, South Carolina. Hello there, buddy.
What do you say there, Giorgio? I'll tell you what, buddy. This is a fantastic show tonight, George. And I was just telling Gina just before that y'all played Timothy Leary's dad.
Yep.
No. He's outside looking in. But
your singing debut is not going to work, but the good try.
Well, hey, listen, I never claimed to be a pro.
Ray Thomas wrote the song, and I'm sure he'd pat you on the back and give you an A for effort.
You got that part right. But listen, now, Timothy Leary was a fascinating character, and I'm so glad that your guest has talked about him, because I have learned more just in listening to tonight's show about Timothy than I've ever known before.
I think everybody has.
Yeah, it's the truth. That is so prophetic that the Moody Blues, of course, did that Timothy Leary's dad song. And anyway, that's all I had to say, basically. And keep it up the good work, George. I tell you what, you guys are absolutely terrific. And that Dan Galante, boy, he played my song right after Gina and I talked about it.
How about that? All right. The callers love you, Paul.
That's terrific. And, you know, to know more about Timothy Leary, as I said, read his book, Flashbacks, one of my favorite books. But also want to say that his publisher, Ronan Press, they've republished a lot of his books in shorter books where they've sort of made them more accessible, put a lot of punchy captions into them. One of them, Timothy Leary, they call Musings on Human Metamorphosis, and they asked me to write the foreword to it, which I did. Not a bad foreword, I think. You know, I recommend his books in their original publications, but if you don't have a lot of time, you can get these shorter, breezier editions that are rarely more than 100 pages from Ronan Press.
I would have loved to have interviewed him had he been around with me.
Yeah. It was a thrill. It was just a thrill to be, you know, that close with him. And, you know, he was, you know, people have said, oh, he was an acid burnout toward the end of his life. And, you know, not true. This man was so sharp. He was so on top of all the details of his life and forward thinking and able to express himself so incredibly well in these interviews.
And by the way, he might have been alive today with the way they treat prostate cancer.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. He'd be 101, I think, something like that. But, yeah.
Next up, let's go to Mike, Yuma, Arizona. Hello, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much.
Sure thing.
A quick question. Why did he run for governor when he was a high-value, high-visible target? Why didn't he just lay low? Or was it because of his, you know, puff-the-magic-dragon kind of mentality? So why did he run instead of staying low?
Well, let me say he had sort of gotten swept up in the whole concept of celebrity along the way. People told him to lay low all along the way.
Did he have an ego?
Going back to Millbrook, they said, keep it quiet. They won't bother you if you don't publicize this. But by the time with the, you know, he really didn't want Ronald Reagan as governor. And, you know, so maybe it was a publicity thing. And maybe it was very, very foolish in terms of his own personal safety, because he was a target and he was already indicted and he already had years in prison hanging over his head and he's out on bail, you know. But he didn't care. And this was the really difficult thing to accept about his personality. He just, bullheadedly forged ahead in every instance with what he wanted to do and what he thought was right without concern for his personal consequences.
He ended up dying in Los Angeles. Were you out here when he died?
Yes. Yes, he died in the home that he was renting in Beverly Hills, the home where we filmed the interviews with him.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's take some final calls.
As a matter of fact, you know, they say his final words, I wasn't there to hear them, that he sort of sat up in bed briefly and he said, why? And then he said, why not? And then he died.
Sam Kinison said, wow, oh wow.
Mm.
Steven Jobs said something like that too. Same thing.
Mm.
They must see something.
Mm-hmm.
Dustin in Wichita, Kansas. Hey, Dustin, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hello, Matt George. And who is your guest tonight?
Paul Davids.
Paul David. Hello. Nice to meet you, sir. I haven't heard you before, but you guys were earlier talking about Roswell. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
All right. Roswell. And I know you guys talk about UFOs a lot on this channel, whatnot, but Roswell, I believe, it wasn't a real UFO. It was a weather balloon that they portrayed as a UFO to make probably confuse KGB spies out nearby White Sands Missile Base.
Well, that's
where they had the Trinity test. They're doing a lot of crazy
stuff. Yeah, they're doing a lot of stuff out there, to be sure. But what happened is the government said it was a weather balloon after the fact, and they had Roger Ramey, didn't they, would spread out all this stuff?
Yep. Yeah, Roger Ramey's adjutant, Colonel Thomas Jefferson DuBose, said absolutely pointedly in an interview that that was all a cover-up. It was not a weather balloon. The material was absolutely so sensitive that it was sent under armed guard to various bases. And, you know, in the course of making the movie, I heard from many high-level people who insisted that it was, in fact, an alien craft. And that includes Gordon Cooper, first American to orbit the Earth.
Mm-hmm. Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14.
Edgar Mitchell, who was from Roswell, and he insisted it was. So there's a lot of disinformation out there. And, of course, the Mogul balloon report from the government didn't help. But they're not coming clean on that. I don't think they want to go back in time, back in history, and concede anything being real about any of the early cases. What we're seeing now is their concession that in the present time, over the last 5 to 10 years, that they're able to validate certain physical craft doing things in the atmosphere that they can't explain and that we can't duplicate. So that's as far as they're going.
Paul, what did you think of the June 25th government report that really told us nothing?
It told us nothing. You know, I kind of agree with Steve Bassett that it's a strategic effort to slowly worm their way out of a 75-year lie, that they can't just come out and admit that they've been concealing all this from us for our entire lifetime. But their first step is to say, look, we do have the evidence. There are things we can't explain. So where are they going to go from here? At what point do they admit that there might be non-human intelligence involved? Well, they're not ready to do that yet. And we can only guess if they'll ever be ready to do that. But we've certainly seen enough evidence, and we've heard from enough witnesses, abductees. I myself was a witness to a craft. Didn't see any aliens, but the craft was, it defied anything that I'd seen before in aviation. So it's a slow way for them to worm themselves out of a long-standing lie and not look so bad. That's political.
Well, absolutely. Paul, again, let's first of all talk about some of your books. Where can people get them?
Okay. So if you go to Amazon, you can find Blowing America's Mind, a true story of Princeton, CIA Mind Control, LSD and Zen. That's the subtitle. You can find my book that I co-wrote with Dr. Gary Schwartz called An Atheist in Heaven, The Ultimate Evidence for Life After Death. That's at Amazon. You can find my Star Wars books online. Just Google them, go to Amazon. The books are The Glove of Darth Vader, The Lost City of the Jedi, Zorba the Hutt's Revenge, Mission from Mount Yoda, Queen of the Empire, and Prophets of the Dark Side. And I want to say that The Gimwits, that book series for the young ones is at Amazon Kindle. Or you can go to thegimwits.com and get e-versions of the books there. There's also printed versions available from Lulu. And my art books, they're all under The Art of Paul Jeffrey Davids, and you have The Art of Paul Jeffrey Davids, the Southwest, Art of Paul Jeffrey Davids, Mexico and New York, Mexico, and then you have New York and Paris, you have the California coast, you have Forests and Flowers, you have my mixed media pieces that I did with an artist named Russell Metzger of Albuquerque, an exhibit that was shown at the Ritz, the Ritz in Laguna Beach. And, you know, that is under Paul Jeffrey Davids. I want to say I'm not Paul Davids, the guitar teacher.
Yeah, you're not that one. Paul, we got to run, but keep in touch with us. We'll get you back on again. Paul Davids with us. Up next, Elizabeth Joyce, the psychic.